sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Do you think you might have migraine? Talk to your healthcare professional about your symptoms, the number of days they impact your life, and which treatment options might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. And the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. The Epilepsy Foundation leads the fight to overcome the challenges of living with epilepsy and to accelerate therapies, stop seizures, find cures, and save lives. Visit epilepsy.com to find out how to get involved today. And by Neurelis, a leading neuroscience company focused on the development and commercialization of therapeutics for the treatment of epilepsy and other neurologic disorders. The company's unique drug portfolio strives to address unmet needs in patient care. Learn more at Neurelis.com.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joe Servin, a neurologist who practices at the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida. This is What's Health Got to Do with It, which looks at where and how healthcare intersects with your life, helping you get the medical answers you want. Coming up, our September Medical Roundtable. Then, a new art exhibit at MoCA Jacksonville featuring art by Wolfson's Children's Hospital patients. But first, your September health headlines in about a minute. We start with good news. First, welcome to our second season of What's Health Got to Do with It? Next, the Director General of the World Health Organization declared, and I quote, "We've never been in a better position to end the pandemic." We're not there yet, but the end is in sight, close quote. He made these remarks after noting that the number of weekly reported deaths from COVID-19 was the lowest since March 2020. President Biden went one step further, declaring the pandemic over in the United States on a 60 Minutes interview. Yet despite that good news, COVID long haulers are still battling the troubling aftermath of COVID, otherwise known as long COVID. And monkeypox cases have begun to fall in some areas in the last several weeks, but are still rising in some areas of the country. So, open quote, "we approach this news with cautious optimism," said CDC Director Rochelle Walensky. She further went on to say, in the U.S., there have been 22,000 confirmed infections. Lastly, health experts are warning the nation to brace for what could be an exceptionally severe flu season this fall and winter, as more people who have not built up immunity over the last few years mix and mingle. That's your September monthly health headlines in about a minute. Joining us to delve into all of this are not one, not two, but four highly experienced healthcare voices. First, we welcome Daniel Correa. He is Deputy Chief of Neurology at the Montefiore Medical Center in New York City. He's editor of the Brain and Life podcast for the American Academy of Neurology. Dr. Correa, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here. Also joining us is Dr. Sunil Joshi. He is a practicing internist and allergy immunology specialist in Jacksonville and chair of the Duval County Medical Society Foundation. Dr. Joshi, welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Servin. Happy to be here.
It's great to have you. We also have Dr. Juliana Kling. She's a practicing women's health specialist and chair of the Division of Women's Health at Mayo Clinic in Scottsdale, Arizona. Dr. Kling, welcome back.
Thanks so much, and congrats on your second season.
Appreciate it. And last but certainly not least, Dr. Dacre Knight. He's a practicing internist and chair of the Ehlers-Danlos Syndrome Clinic at Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida. Dr. Knight, welcome.
Thanks so much. As always, great to be here.
It's great to have you here. Dr. Joshi, we'll start with you. Is the pandemic over as far as you're concerned?
Well, it's a good question considering the president's recent comments, but I think the way I would look at this is we're in a definitely in a different spot. The pandemic has changed significantly over the last few years, and we're in a much better spot. As you had mentioned in your headlines, you know, we now have the lowest number of deaths since March of 2020. We have ways to diagnose COVID, we have ways to treat it, and we have ways to prevent it. with vaccinations. And so we're in a much better spot. People are still getting COVID, but the severity of the illness is significantly reduced compared to previously, and hospitalization numbers are also going down. So yes, I think we're getting closer to the end, and we can feel better that we've done, for the most part, done as much as we could to prevent worse outcomes.
Dr. Kling, what advice do you have regarding COVID vaccines and boosters at this time? What are you telling your patients?
Yeah, it's important to make sure that you're up to date on your vaccines. We have the new bivalent COVID booster that protects against the more recent strains of Omicron that are available. And so it's now recommended by the CDC that all of us that have had our vaccines, or maybe those that even haven't, take the opportunity to get that booster, especially as we go into the fall season where we're going to see increasing numbers of potentially COVID, but also influenza, to make sure and protect ourselves and our families.
Dr. Knight, speaking of the bivalent COVID booster, Dr. Kling just gave us a nice description that it's out there. But who should be getting this? Is this for everybody?
Yeah, it is exciting to have these advances always coming up and help us through this time through the pandemic. Now, should everyone be getting it? Yeah, so there are certain age groups. So there's a Moderna version that's available for ages 18 and up. There's a Pfizer version available for ages 12 and up. And yes, it would be anyone at this point, as long as you haven't had a recent infection. So that still applies. And then maybe want to wait a period of time too, if you've had a recent vaccine that's not this bivalent version.
Dr. Correa, The Atlantic published an article on brain fog, one of the most difficult symptoms of the long COVID condition. They define brain fog, otherwise known as executive dysfunction. Is there any advice you have to folks who are suffering with this? How to combat it or make it less severe in any way?
It is kind of a vague name, but funnily, it fits sort of with the visual of fog. It can have so many different causes and involve so many symptoms. And executive dysfunction, just meaning a broader definition of slowing or difficulty with all the different processes of the brain's thinking. So engaging in cognitive activities, both socializing, trying to work on cognitive games, not necessarily withdrawing, are all ways that individuals can try to work on combating the brain fog. Additionally, some people are describing that exercise activity can help the brain fog that comes with many other neurologic conditions, but also potentially from long COVID. So I would really suggest doing cognitive activities, brain games and activities, maintaining socially engaged, and trying to slowly increase your physical activity as all ways to combat the brain fog. And my own perspective and fear on long COVID and these symptoms is one of the reasons why I myself have gotten the new bivalent COVID booster.
Let me ask a follow-up to that. Is this symptom of brain fog, is this something that you've seen with other patients? Is this something that stays with them for good, or does it go away in a few weeks, a few months? Can you give us any sense of that part of it?
So with long COVID patients, but also with the many of the other conditions that can have brain fog. So some people can have brain fog come as a part of their migraine, or some people with multiple sclerosis can have brain fog occur with some of their lesions or the occurrences of their condition. And for many of those people, it's a symptom that can go away with some time. Now, for each condition and with long COVID, it varies to whether or not it lasts weeks or longer. And that might have to do with how much people are getting an opportunity to do activities that may help reduce it. So trying to increase their sleep, and as I mentioned, both cognitive activities and physical activities are all ways that people can try to reduce the time that they have the brain fog.
Dr. Joshi, CDC Director Dr. Walensky, she commented that monkeypox cases nationally are declining, but not everywhere. And according to the CDC, and at the time of this taping, there's been 2,301 monkeypox cases and only two reported deaths nationally. Is the worst over for monkeypox?
Well, that's also a good question. I think the cases are definitely declining throughout the country. There may be some pockets where they haven't yet. And I think what's important to note is that there's a vaccine for monkeypox as well. And maybe what needs to be done is focus on vaccinating in that higher risk population. And if we can do that, in particular the underserved population, I think we can get to the point where the worst is over for monkeypox. It definitely is on the decline. And there are parts of this country where we need to focus on vaccination so that we can continue to see those numbers drop.
Dr. Joshi, on that point, who should be getting the monkeypox vaccine anyway?
Yeah, I mean, you know, typically it's the people at high risk. So, you know, what we're seeing is that the vast majority of cases, especially in the bigger cities, 98 and 99% of the cases are occurring in homosexual men who are having close contact with another person who may have monkeypox. And so these are the folks that are at risk and should consider getting vaccinated. And there are some studies recently suggesting that the groups of people who are at highest risk of getting it are Hispanic males, who are also the lowest vaccinated group as well. So another reason for that particular group to be targeted for vaccine.
Dr. Kling, how worried should folks be about outbreaks in places like daycare facilities, schools, offices, and other crowded places?
Yeah, I think as we're seeing these numbers going down, it's really reassuring. I know there had been concerns about outbreaks in daycares, and it's certainly something to monitor, watch, you know, for new symptoms of your kids. What's going to be tricky is we're going into the season of infections, of viruses, you know, but if you do notice those things in your kids or your family members, making sure that you're taking those precautions and keeping them at home so we're limiting community spread.
One last question, and Dr. Knight, on this topic, and this is monkeypox. I want to just make sure, because this is always gets us into a question of concern in terms of who's getting monkeypox. Do we not view this as a sexually transmitted disease, or do we view it in another way?
Yeah, that's a good question. So as Dr. Joshi was talking about, who is at risk for these? So it seems like it's the contact. So it's not necessarily, you know, sexual intercourse per se that is causing the transmission. So it's the contact. So especially where there may be open wounds or the pox virus actually present. So the skin to skin contact, which obviously occurs during sexual intercourse, but this is not necessarily sexually transmitted. It's the contact that is concerning. So there are certain groups that have increased frequency of these infections. So those are the ones that should be more concerned and maybe more interested in getting the vaccines.
Got it. Dr. Correa, outgoing Chief White House Medical Advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci said the U.S. should prepare for a pretty bad flu season later this year. Why do you think health officials are now sounding alarms about the flu?
You know, so I think it's that we need to remember the importance of vaccines. Some people have, you know, develop some more vaccine hesitance, part of our COVID discussion, but there are so many other conditions that people aren't getting vaccines for. And there's concern that people, even fewer people, will get the flu vaccine. Further, you know, so many of us have had less contact and we're getting right back into a full season of the fall and viruses and people both being in public transportation and schools and crowded environments. So these are all the perfect environments for something like the flu vaccine and other coronaviruses or cold viruses to really pick up the pace and be involved. And we have to remember that for some people, the flu virus and illness can be very dangerous and lead to significant respiratory problems and put people in the hospital.
Dr. Joshi, when should folks get their flu vaccine?
Well, this is a good time to get it. You know, September and October are probably the two best months to get it. Keep in mind, it takes about 2 weeks for the vaccine to take effect for you to have immunity after receiving the vaccine. And they tend to be good for about 6 to 8 months before you start to have declining immunity. And our peak of the flu season, depending on what part of the country you're in, is anywhere between December and March. So by getting the vaccine now, you will have protected immunity through the worst part of the flu season. So this is a great time to get it. I find that a lot of my patients, if they wait until after Halloween or into November to get the vaccine, that they just forget to get it because the holidays come in and before you know it, it's January and you haven't been vaccinated yet. So this is a great time to get it. here in September and October.
Dr. Kling, what should you do if you suspect you might have the flu? How soon do you need to start antivirals for them to be effective?
Yeah, that's a great question. Maybe, you know, first, if you think you have the flu, similar to how we approach COVID, making sure that you're isolating yourself so that you're not spreading it within your community. So make sure you stay home if you have a cough or fever or flu-like symptoms. Then reaching out to your clinician, your physician, or your advanced practitioner to see if you're a candidate for an antiviral, which you'll need to do within the first 5 days of development. Those symptoms. Otherwise, you're going to focus on symptomatic measures, medication to lower your fever, medication to help with your cough, rest, and hydration.
To all our listeners out there, you're listening to the first episode of season 2 of What's Health Got to Do With It on WJCT News 89.9. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and if you're just joining us, this is our September monthly medical roundtable. Now, some of our doctors will leave us shortly to tend to their patients, but until they do, let's continue our conversation. Dr. Kling, with regards to the flu specifically, when should folks start using antivirals for those antivirals to be effective, especially if you suspect you might have it?
Yeah, no, that's an excellent question. I think the first point to say is if people are noticing symptoms, fevers, cough, those type of things, it's important, just like we've done with COVID, to make sure you isolate so you don't, continue to spread within your community. For those that are at higher risk, if they're severely ill or immunocompromised, they should reach out to their doctors to get started on antivirals within the first 48 hours of their symptoms.
Got it. I appreciate that. Let's go to a slightly different topic. Now, after virtually disappearing for several years amid measures aimed at curbing the spread of COVID-19, the CDC is now urging doctors to be vigilant for a renewed wave of enterovirus D68 or EVD68, a viral infection in children that can cause a rare kind of paralysis. In July and August, the CDC says hospitals detected an increase in infections caused by the enterovirus D68, and the number is now the biggest seen since 2018 when the agency tracks the last wave of summer and fall infections caused by this virus. Dr. Knight, what is an enterovirus, and should we be worried about this?
Yes, the enterovirus is more seen in the pediatric population right now. And certainly with some of the outcomes that are quite severe, we should be worried about it. Now, fortunately, it's not as highly transmissible and as widespread as some of these other infections and coronavirus and other things that we've seen. But it is something that has come to our attention because there are more cases that are coming into the hospitals. There is not yet any specific vaccine we have for it, so it does make it concerning, but there is still some treatment that we can give to patients if they are recognizing this as early as possible. One of the outcomes that has come from this that is similar to, but not quite the same as polio, is the acute flaccid myelitis, so meaning that there is some degree of paralysis that goes with this. So it is certainly reason to be concerned.
And just to follow up a little, is there any symptoms that our listeners should watch out for that should make you suspicious for this?
Well, some of the symptoms are quite vague to begin with. So that does mean that it can be some troublesome, as far as detecting it goes. But there are things like just general, malaise, the increased fevers, other things like the respiratory complications that can arise. So shortness of breath, increased coughing, wheezing, things like that. So it's always good to be in close contact with your pediatrician if any of those symptoms arise, so that they can kind of go through the course of what would be the next steps in the evaluation process.
So let me switch to yet another topic, a very different one. A panel of federal health advisors voted in early September to recommend approval for an experimental drug to treat Lou Gehrig's disease, or ALS, which is a remarkable turnaround for the much-debated medication that was previously rejected by the same group earlier this year. The FDA advisors voted 7-2 that data from Amylyx Pharma warranted approval despite hours of debate about the strength and reliability of the company's lone study. Now, the FDA is not required to follow the group's advice, but its positive recommendation suggests an approval is likely later this month. Now, to me, this sounds like a little bit of deja vu for the Alzheimer's drug aducanumab and its approval. So, Dr. Correa, what is ALS and what's going on with this drug's approval?
Well, so yeah, to start off, ALS is a rare and can lead to a fatal neurologic condition that can leave people unable to walk, talk, and swallow and breathe. It injures the neurons that control our muscles. And for this medication, it's true. For many neurologists, many specialists out there in the field, it's still not clear whether this drug called AMX0035 truly helps people with ALS. It's a combination of two existing products or medicines out there. One's a dietary supplement, and the other one is a medication called sodium phenylbutyrate. It's used now to treat some rare metabolic conditions. And the combination is thought to possibly slow down ALS, not actually end up preventing or stopping it, and hopefully preventing the destruction of cells. And as you mentioned, they had one small study. So it has 137 people. And in that small group of people, it did show that there was potentially some delay in the progression of the condition for over a few months. The question then being, is that strong enough evidence really for this? And so many people are still waiting to find out really more information about, are there certain people that would actually benefit from this, or how do we study that further? But we have to acknowledge also that, like Alzheimer's, there and many other medical conditions, there's a broad community out there living with these severe neurologic conditions and are really advocating and helping push forward science. And so some of that work has gone towards more attention to allow more attention and awareness to get more science. So it's possible, like with aducanumab, and then maybe this promise of AMX0035 for ALS, that maybe with more attention and more study, certain people with unique characteristics in their health or their ALS diagnosis could benefit. But it's not clear really to many of the specialists out there in the field. And so we're not sure if this is really going to be more of a provisional or experimental treatment approval. And what are going to be the specifics?
That's super helpful. Let me also now switch to a very different topic once again. Dr. Joshi, about 15,000 nurses in Minnesota walked off the job to demand better pay and more robust staffing. They say that is desperately needed to improve patient care. Nurses at seven hospitals in the Minneapolis and the Duluth metro areas halted work in mid-September in what the union says is the largest strike ever by private sector nurses. Now, the hospitals did recruit temporary nurses to maintain most services during the three-day strike. So my question to you, is this an omen for things to come? Can we expect more nursing or even possibly a doctor strike?
I do think this is an omen for things to come. There is no doubt that in this country, healthcare workers, doctors, nurses, medical assistants have been taken for granted for years. This is not just because of COVID, though COVID has made the conditions worse. This has been an ongoing issue, in particular with hospitals, insurance companies, et cetera. And the way that nurses are worked in hospitals and now are taking care of multiple patients in the ICU at one time has made it very, very difficult. And the working conditions, the hours, are not anywhere near ideal. And the pay is not close to commensurate as well. And so this is something that I do expect to see happen more frequently. And, you know, doctors, we've talked in the past about doctors striking, and there are some antitrust reasons as to why we cannot. But that's something that I believe at some point in the future will be challenged. And something has to change, because the burnout rate for physicians and nurses, healthcare workers in general, are skyrocketing. And the hospital's response is typically providing programming to make people more resilient or to help them through through their issues, as opposed to preventing these things from happening in the first place. And that's where we need to be focused.
I guess this is going to be a stay tuned as we watch to see what happens with this. Dr. Kling, women tend to put on extra pounds during midlife, increasing the risk for obesity and related conditions like hypertension, diabetes, heart disease, stroke, and some cancers. That's the reasoning for new recommendations from a federally supported group of OBGYNs, family physicians, and other health professionals. They're urging doctors to counsel female patients ages 40 to 60 who are normal weight or overweight about ways to prevent obesity. Now, I'm a guy. I don't want to get a weight loss lecture from my doctor, even though it's probably appropriate. So I guess my question to you, is this a good idea? Do you counsel women about weight, even if they're at normal weight?
Well, as a kind of public health trained physician focused on prevention for my patients, I think any opportunity you have to collaborate or work with somebody to talk about ways to improve their health and prevent disease is beneficial. I suspect some of the pushback about this is how it's being presented, and because weight can be triggering, and there's a lot of stigma in our society about weight. And so doing so in a way that's supportive and collaborative with our patients, most patients know if they need to focus on their weight and what tools they need to do that. So if we can do something to say, hey, let's acknowledge this is an opportunity, and how can we collaborate together to make you as successful as possible? As a menopause practitioner, what I find the most beneficial about this report or this, you know, information recommendation rather, is that calling to attention that at midlife is when us women start to increase those risks of things like heart disease and stroke. And so we truly can have a profound impact on our lives and our future health by recognizing that and doing things and implementing healthy habits at that time.
Good advice as always. Here's our last question to Dr. Correa. The Emmy Awards were just held, and the last award of the night for Best Drama was presented by Selma Blair, a celebrity making headlines as she battles multiple sclerosis publicly and is even on Dancing with the Stars now. So my question to you, what is multiple sclerosis, MS, and is her case typical or atypical? She looks amazing.
She did. And big congratulations to all the team there at Ted Lasso. I enjoyed watching the Emmys. But so MS is a condition where a person's own immune system, we all have become more aware of it with COVID, but the person's own immune system injures the wrapping around the nerve fibers in their eyes, their brain, and their spinal cord. It can have different types, and so that affects a lot about the types of symptoms and the progress of the condition over time. But the most common is a type where the inflammation and the damage can come and go with fluctuating symptoms that occur over days and sometimes will then improve weeks later. Over time, without treatment, some people can have a development of lasting symptoms and challenges with many of the functions of their daily life. But thankfully, the old perspective that people with MS or multiple sclerosis would get worse and worse and all be in wheelchairs is really false. We've seen now that with some of the newer treatments, that many people can stay very stable throughout their condition and independent for many years. So then you asked, you know, is Selma Blair's, you know, own response typical? And that really depends on that type of MS. We're glad to see Selma Blair is doing so well and advocating for others living with MS. She had a special type of stem cell transplant for her MS and has responded very well. This has been done in some people that where the newest and most effective medications either can't work, don't work, or they have some risks and side effects with it. But stem cell transplant right now is not very common for MS, but there are many other really highly effective medications. And what's most important is that the medications for all the types of MS can help each person gain better control of the condition, reduce those numbers of attacks or that inflammation process, and that a selection of those medicines should be done with someone who's a specialist in MS and understands that person's own condition and their life situation. And for anyone who wants some more information and stories about living with MS, we have interviewed and featured several people living with MS on the Brain and Life podcast. I know that you're aware of from the American Academy of Neurology.
Thank you, Dr. Correa. A quick follow-up. You mentioned a lot of these treatments. Some are quite pricey. I guess my quick follow-up is, number one, is that just the norm? You have to be to access this, you're going to have insurance. And then the other quick question is this a condition of young women?
So it used to sort of be falsely thought that it was just young women who got it. And it turns out really in every part of the world and in every group, if you look truly with a MS center and MS specialist, if MS exists, that it's still there. But it does happen a little bit more often in women than men. And it does tend to present in the younger age groups, but it can show up at different age stages. And that is, unfortunately, you mentioned the cost of these medicines. It's unfortunately an issue with a lot of these newer medicines that come out, both because of the time and money that goes into the research, and because sometimes with small groups, medicines get priced at high levels because the companies, you know, see an opportunity to potentially make back some of that cost. It is important to try and address with your doctors whether or not you could be eligible for Medicare and Medicaid and other forms of payment that could help get you the medicines that are best for that person. Or if you have an opportunity for any best insurance, and then that way that insurance you can work through with your doctors getting it authorized. Each of the medicines is going to be a little bit different. So it really has to do with working with a doctor and a team that can help work with you as an advocate for the medication options that are best for you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Correa. Well, we had to say goodbye to two of our physicians, Dr. Sunil Joshi and to Dr. Juliana Kling. Both of them have patients waiting for them, and I do not want to be responsible for making them late to see their patients, but we are so appreciative of them giving us their time. But right now, it's time for our social media mailbag. Mr. Postman. And our associate producer, Catherine Hobbs, joins us now with questions for our experts from our listeners. Catherine, what do we have in store today?
Hey, Dr. Servin. Our first question today comes from Andrea in Gainesville. She writes to us and says, with the specific new COVID vaccine aimed at Omicron, which COVID vaccine should she be getting? And is it okay to get the flu vaccine at the same time?
Dr. Knight, you want to take that for us?
Happy to. Yes, this is an important question. And the question pertains to which vaccine to get. So I would recommend the bivalent vaccine. So this is the one that has just come out recently. And the reason for that is that there is increased protection against the newer variants. Okay, so the Omicron variants, the BA5 variant, as it's called now, is what's known to affect almost 90% of cases that currently have COVID. So this is the advantage of this newer vaccine. So I would recommend that one. Now, the second part of the question, I believe, was related to the flu vaccine and timing of that. So yes, you can absolutely get them at the same time. The topic of flu vaccines came up earlier when we were talking about the timing, because the flu vaccine usually peaks in the midwinter months, so January, February. So you don't have to overthink it. You can get them both together. It's better to get something than nothing at all. But if you're going to try to time it based on the peak of the flu season, then it is generally better to get the flu vaccine, you know, towards the fall months of October, November, so that would be really efficacious to preventing severe flu.
Which really is now, if you look at the calendar, right?
Right. Yeah, it's coming. Time's flying by, right? Can't believe it's already, you know, September. So yeah, it's moving into November, October. So yeah, as soon as you can get it, it's good.
I appreciate that. Catherine, what else do we have?
Anderson wrote to us from Los Angeles saying, I understand that the new COVID booster for Omicron was approved without any human clinical trials. Is this a safe vaccine to get?
Dr. Correa, what about that? That's one of those details that always kind of raises an eyebrow these days.
It's an excellent question. But, you know, I think something for us to remember is that each year, some of our vaccines are updated to what are the variants of the viruses that are out there that we need to be protected of. And the most common example of that is the flu vaccine we were just talking about. And so through monitoring the types of virus variants that are most prevalent, that helps the preventive medicine and public health specialists out there predict and pick what needs to be protected of. And so this is basically the same format of this new COVID booster that protects against BA4 and BA5, in addition to the other previous variants that were included. So I'm not really concerned that it didn't have separate human clinical trials. The treatment and the vaccine had extensive study before, and then so many people now in the world have received it without any other awareness of other complication rates that we weren't aware of. We have to remember, at this point now, this COVID vaccine is now one of the few medical treatments that has been seen and used by one of the largest number of humans in our world than any other treatment that we use. So we really know, in a way, more about this treatment than many other treatments that we use in medicine.
That is an excellent point that I often think does not get brought up. There are so many people that have been on this vaccine. Thank you so much for that. Catherine, what else do we have?
Melanie from Phoenix asks, is the enterovirus that the CDC issued an alert about the same thing as polio? And should she get a polio vaccine or a booster?
Dr. Knight, I know you brought this up when we asked you about enterovirus earlier, but, you know, it's a good question because of the concern about polio and that headline separately. What is the thing that a patient should do out there? Anything or just be vigilant?
Well, the similarity between polio and enterovirus of the flaccid paralysis is enough to think that there could be something associated. But they are actually two separate viruses and two separate pathways of how these happen. So the polio vaccine does not necessarily protect against these enterovirus and the flaccid paralysis that comes with it. Having said that, it's always a good thing to be up to date on your vaccines. And if you have records of those, you can check back to see which vaccines you've had. Now is as good of time as any to make sure all your vaccines are updated, not only the flu and COVID vaccines. So that would be good to do. And then, yes, do be vigilant in any case to monitor for any signs and symptoms and stay in close contact with your primary doctor.
Catherine, what else do we have there?
Beth in Houston says, my father has been diagnosed with ALS and I'm heartbroken. How effective is the new ALS drug that may get approved, and is it a cure?
Dr. Carrera, I know you brought this up also as well. This gets a lot of people's attention because ALS is a very difficult to manage condition. Can you again kind of go over about this particular drug?
Completely. And Beth, you know, I'm so sorry. And, you know, our thoughts are particularly with you, your family, and your father. This is a very challenging condition to deal with, both as an individual and as a family. And unfortunately, this is not a cure. I mean, I think that is the short answer. We are still all out there in search of, and researchers are working on something that will work towards a cure. The next best thing sometimes we hope for is for a medicine that really stops a medical condition in its process. And unfortunately, this does not appear to be that kind of treatment either. Currently, the evidence that was provided by the company to the FDA was a study on 137 patients. And in that group, there was some proportion of the patients that the condition was delayed over a few months. So they still progressed. It didn't stop the condition, but it did provide some delay. And there's question as to whether or not that's better than some of the other medicines that are out there for ALS and its benefit, and really what the balance of the other risks and benefits of it. And I think some of that is going to be information we're going to need as the data and the information that's provided to the FDA and from this company move forward. We don't know if there are specific groups of people with ALS or types of ALS that may benefit more than others, And so as that information comes out, I think it could be important for your father and people living with MS to follow up with their specialists to discuss their treatment options and other options to deal with many of the other problems that can come along with that affect their quality of life with ALS.
We're going to let that be our last word. Dr. Correa, I just want to thank you so very much for joining us and giving us some of your wisdom and great advice as always. We really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure, and I was glad to be back and join you all here on the radio again.
I appreciate it. And Dr. Knight, you are a frequent flyer with us. We love having your expertise. We really appreciate you joining us today.
I truly enjoyed it and always happy to do it. Thank you so much.
We bet. You bet. It's always wonderful to have you here. We have been talking to an incredible collection of doctor experts. We had Dr. Daniel Correa, Deputy Chief of Neurology at the Montefiore Medical Center in New York City, editor of the Brain and Life podcast for the American Academy of Neurology. We had Dr. Dacre Knight. He's a practicing internist and chair of the Ehlers-Danlos Syndrome Clinic at Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida. And previously, we had Dr. Sunil Joshi, a practicing internist and allergy immunology specialist in Jacksonville and chair of the Duval County Medical Society Foundation. Last but not least, Dr. Juliana Kling, a practicing women's health specialist and chair of the Division of Women's Health at Mayo Clinic in Scottsdale, Arizona. And up next, Art with a Heart in Healthcare, a new art exhibit at Mocha Jacks. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and this is What's Health Got to Do With It. As a doctor who's practiced over several decades, I've come to some fundamental realizations about what leads to good health outcomes and improved quality of life. More and more, I realize that science alone cannot totally heal us. Rather, empathy and compassion are almost as important as good medical care. Sometimes the only way to understand what my patient is going through is by looking at their art, which helps to communicate, often nonverbally, what that illness is like. Fortunately, many visionaries understand that truth and have created amazing programs to help all of us understand someone's healthcare plight. Such an example is demonstrated by our next guest. For a decade, the Mocha in Jacksonville and Art with a Heart in Healthcare have collaborated on special exhibitions of artworks by pediatric patients in Northeast Florida. A decade of Art with a Heart, celebrating 10 years of partnership, is a retrospective of select works from past exhibitions. This exhibition would not be possible without the generous support of Florida Blue. We welcome artist-in-residence and communications manager for Art with a Heart in Healthcare, Brooke McKinney, to our program. Brooke, welcome to our show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here. So for those who are uninitiated, can you tell us about Art with a Heart in Healthcare, the organization?
I would love to. Art with a Heart in Healthcare has been around for over 20 years. We are a team of artists in residence, community volunteers, and interns from the University of North Florida. And we work 6 days a week to provide patients and their families in the hospital with healing fine art sessions. We also work in other facilities as well, providing art for adults. And we work with patients alone at the bedside or in groups with other patients as well.
So how does this program work in the hospital?
So each day we have a list that we get from child life specialists with referrals for patients who would be good candidates for doing art or patients who would benefit the most from making art. And then we go around to their rooms asking them if they would like to participate. They are not in any means pressured or forced to make art. It's It's totally up to them if they want to participate. And if they do, then we provide them with all the materials they want to create. And we are there with them every step of the way to help their creative process.
How did the program get started here in Jacksonville?
The program was started by two cousins who both believed that the hospital needed art in order to help patients fully heal. Because like you said, medicine can help to cure, but without art giving us a sense of humanity and hope, it's a lot harder to heal. So art helps us with that, to feel whole and to heal.
So we're excited about the 2022 exhibition. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so this year's exhibition is called What Lifts You Up? And it is answering the question, what helps you feel happy when you're having a bad day or going through a difficult time? It's 16 pediatric patients of Wolfson Children's Hospital who created art that is an expression of who they are and what brings them joy. So each artwork features hot air balloons to symbolize rising above tough situations and elevating one's mood and mindset. Each work of art highlights the patient's individuality and unique art styles.
How were the works selected for the exhibition? I imagine over 10 years, you must have a huge collection.
Yeah, so our 10-year show is actually last year's show, and it featured artwork from the past 10 years of shows. We strive to just include a diverse group of patients and artwork and highlight a few pieces from each year. And then this year, the patients are just selected based on who's in the hospital at the time of while we're preparing for the show.
Can you tell us a little bit about the patient artists that created the works? I know they're pediatric, as you stated, so they're kids. But are these folks in there for chronic conditions? They're long time, short time? How? Tell us a little bit about those artists.
The patients range in age from in the show from about 6 to 19 years old. They are in the hospital for a whole variety of reasons. We work with each floor of the hospital. So from oncology to neurology, they're there for a whole gamut of reasons. I know one patient in particular that I worked with, she was actually hospitalized for a few months. For her particular situation, she had to be there for a few months leading up to her surgery. So it was a really special thing that she got to work on during her time there. It was something to look forward to throughout this really long hospitalization. And I got to know her really well. And she was just so thrilled to be able to make this artwork that's going to be in the museum.
That's amazing. How do you think art helps the patient and their families? What is it about creating art that is therapeutic?
Art is a way for patients to express themselves and to regain their sense of identity. When they get into the hospital, they're given a patient number, their belongings are taken from them, they're all wearing a gown, they're all wearing the same thing. There's really nothing that differentiates them aside from what it is that they're able to, you know, hang up in their room or to express through their artwork.
So how do you think art is therapeutic for the patient and their families?
Art helps to provide an outlet of expression in a time where their identities are stripped from them in the hospital setting. They are given a number, their belongings are taken away. And so art is a way to express the complex emotions that they're dealing with. It's a way to personalize their rooms. They can hang up their art. It starts conversations with healthcare personnel and helps them get to know who they are as a person and not just as a patient. In addition, the special relationship, the non-clinical relationship formed between artists and residents and patients helps to humanize the healthcare setting and allows them to get to know people on a personal level and not in a medical sense.
Brooke, how can our listeners find out more about this year's show?
Listeners can visit our website or any of our social media pages. We will be posting reminders and keeping everyone up to date. The show opening is on September 11th from 2 to 4 p.m. at Mocha Jacksonville. And it is a free event and open to the public.
I'm curious, are any of the works of art available for purchase, perhaps as a charity to help the organization, the hospital, or any merchandise related to it? Is that available for sale?
None of the paintings are actually for sale. We choose not to sell patient artwork, but we are always open and very grateful for donations, which can be made through our website. We're a nonprofit and we do rely on the generosity of others to do the work that we do.
Brooke, we're so excited to see the new exhibition. I want to thank you so much for joining us on today's show.
Thank you for having me.
It's been great having you. We've been talking to Brooke McKinney, artist in residence and communications manager for Art with a Heart in Healthcare at Mocha Jacksonville. Well, that's our program for today. We hope you've enjoyed our show. If you missed anything, you can listen to the full episode at WJCT.org and on your favorite podcast app. Thanks to all of our guests. Our executive producer is David Luckin. Heather Schatz is our senior producer. Our associate producer is Catherine Hobbs. Isabella Da Silva is our director. Next week's program addresses the question, can my doctor still practice medicine? Assessing and rehabbing doctors. If you have questions about this or any topic, let us know by calling us at 904-358-6362. Email us at health@wjct.org or tweet me at Jay Servin. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and you're listening to What's Health Got to Do with It on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. Thank you for listening and stay in touch.
Sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Is migraine impacting your life or daily activities 4 or more days per month? If so, ask your healthcare professional if you are a candidate for migraine prevention treatments and which ones might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. And the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. And by the Epilepsy Foundation leads the fight to overcome the challenges of living with epilepsy and to accelerate therapies, stop seizures, find cures, and save lives. Visit epilepsy.com to find out how to get involved today.